Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
Deux, trois nouvelles chansons pour vous, hein? First one's called Starfucker. Baby, baby, I've been so sad since you've been gone. We're back to New York City. Where are you don't belong? Honey, I feel so two-tone kissing. Slap around the child. If I ever get back to Jackson, girl, I'm gonna make you scream all night. I said, honey, honey, call me on the telephone. I know you're moving out to Hollywood.
I saw on Twitter somebody said that the Rolling Stones Brussels concert 1973, which for years has been circulating as a bootleg, is now officially available. And so it's really
what, from the record company? Or?
Not from the record company. No, from the Rolling Stones store. It's a really odd thing, and you can get it as a download.
A little shop.
MP3.
Like, it is just like Stella Street. It's remember that
bit,
little shop?
It's a bit more than a little shop, I think. It's a place where they make money.
Charlie Watts behind the counter.
Charlie, that's right, yeah. It's past its sell-by date.
You remember that bit with Stella? So you can either have it on MP3 or FLAC. Fraser, do you know what FLAC means?
FLAC.
Very good.
Okay.
It's a lossless format. I don't know.
It's better quality, isn't it? So it's either $7 or $9, apparently. So I downloaded this thing, and of course, I've had it for years, but it's very interesting when you can download it legitimately at last.
Is the quality better?
Yeah, the quality is better. And it's, you know, as we've frequently discussed on the podcast, it's the Rolling Stones when they were at their best, when Mick Taylor was in the group, you know, that short period of time.
Does any fool know? right-minded person would agree.
It's very basic rock O-level, that is. When were the Rolling Stones best?
Yeah.
They were best when Mick Taylor was in the
right
group.
Right answer.
Tick. Correct. And it's wonderful to hear that stuff. But, of course, it struck me, all classic bootlegs eventually get a legitimate release, do they not? Or am I wrong?
They probably, well, they were all the Dylan ones, did the Dylan series.
Did they? Is that the case?
Well, yeah, there was a great one, All Hallows. Have you ever heard that? It's amazing.
No, is that Bob Dylan?
I suppose it would have been on, whatever it is it October 31? It was in 1964 at the, I've completely forgotten which hall, famous hall in New York, and he brings on Joan Baez, his then-girlfriend, and they sing Silver Dagger together.
Was this Carnegie Hall?
I can't remember now, but it was absolutely epic performance. And that was a bootleg for years, and what he did, rightly, is own all this stuff, and then one by one put them out as the bootleg series, you know. And the same with the Beatles. I mean, that was my big problem, having spent literally just probably thousands of pounds on Beatles bootlegs. I think I have somewhere between 45 and 50 vinyl bootlegs. I mean, just it's that wide,
yeah,
a yard of records. And the value of those, as you can see, was wiped overnight by the arrival of anthology.
Well, except you've still got the
I've still got them. They're vinyl. They're vinyl. They've also got bootleg sleeves, which is quite interesting. The Black of the Black album, of course, which is the white album, the triple, as a replica of the white album, but all done in black, with its own serial number, with its own alternative poster, with its own alternative.
So that has
it's
really
an amazing record. It's also got stuff on it which has never been put out. Actually, amazing stuff.
I tell you the one that struck me recently, Fraser, because I finally got it. Apparently, legitimately, is the Little Feat first bootleg, which was released as Electrif Lycanthrope.
That's right.
In about 1975 or whatever.
Because it was spelt wrong, wasn't it?
It was spelt wrong.
Electrif.
Electrif. There was the limitations of a John Ball printing set, which is what they used to use
back
in those days.
Yeah.
This is now available on something called the Internet Archive. Do you know this?
www.archive.org. Yes.
Which is
it's been on there for a long time.
I know. And so this is a record I bought in the kind of back room of a shop just off Carnaby Street, absolutely years ago, feeling I was going to have my collar felt at any moment. And it's now freely available. Literally free. And it's also, it sounds fantastic. It sounds far better than it did at the time. And here's the point. It's far better than anything Little Feat legitimately released during their career. So I don't know why they haven't put it out.
Not connected with the fact that it's out. Oh, that one isn't out, isn't
it? You can freely get it on the Internet Archive, which is some kind of... It's like a social service, isn't it, the Internet Archive?
And in terms of copyright, most of the stuff that's there is there in allowance of copyright.
It's allowed.
It's not a host for illegal recordings.
No. So please go out and get it. Fill your boots. Enjoy it. It's an absolutely astonishing record. But I can't believe that Warner Brothers haven't put it out, and the Little Feat, who seem to have repackaged all their material one way or another, they haven't put it out either. It's possibly because the ownership of it is somehow disputed.
Did Elvis Costello and the Attractions ever put out Live at the El Mocambo? Remember that record?
I think that was a legit bootleg, actually.
And nothing was bootleg for a long time, but maybe it did come out.
Well, yeah, I've got a Columbia version.
Yeah, yeah. This is so podcast. I've got a Columbia version. Well, I got a signed version of all about. No, that was great because they were doing, I think, a Canadian radio show.
El Mocambo. It was in Toronto.
Toronto. Yeah. And so therefore the sound quality is fantastic. And then it's got that great edge and attack to it because they're a little bit nervous and it's live and it's live radio and it's absolutely magnificent.
So you were wondering, does anybody make... Are there any bootlegs?
Well, I don't know. I mean...
Does such a thing exist?
If some kind of blooper or outtake or terrible mistake occurs, it's usually straight up on some kind of hilarious, you know, YouTube site or something, isn't it? And you can usually see it. Sorry, YouTube. Sorry, YouTube site.
And who are the Beatles? No, we're leaving that in, Mark.
I haven't had much sleep. Sorry.
Because every show is recorded on somebody's mobile phone, finds its way onto YouTube the following day, doesn't it? So the notion that there's official releases. And then odd, unofficial releases.
Yeah.
It's a dead idea, isn't it?
Yeah.
Does it occur anymore, Fraser?
No, I don't think it does, no. I mean, it's funny when you look at audience shots now, all you can see, if it's pointed towards the stage from, say, the sound desk, all you can see is a sea of little blue squares.
It's depressing, isn't it, really? Yeah. It can't go on.
But also, people do record things sort of almost deliberately for box sets, don't they?
So they will record sound checks and they will record... You know, people jamming in a hotel room and all that, in case it could be something that's a kind of archive piece to add on a box set to try and get someone to rebuy something.
Well, I think it's got... Don't you think it's also got to the point now where it's almost more trouble not to record something? You have to decide to switch it off. You know, everything is being recorded all the time.
Yeah.
I must have told you this before. When I went to see Bruce Springsteen when he was playing in Canada and the West Coast of the States about 7 or 8 years ago or whatever, and I was watching the way they, you know, the kind of live video coverage of it. And so every night the show is effectively, because everything is captured, the show is effectively filmed in every respect every night. And so you could go, you know, back to your dressing room afterwards and you just look at the whole thing. And it won't be raw footage. It will have been kind of live edited into some kind of shape that you could look at. You could put it out the following day.
There's bands like the Pixies and Pearl Jam going on tour and then releasing every show as a CD subsequently. Or Yes, for instance, I saw 2 years ago, I think, and as you filed out of the gig at the end of the show, you could buy memory sticks containing the live recording of the performance you'd just witnessed.
They're literally... Yeah.
Download the encores later on, because they hadn't had time.
I have to email those to you, because you got them when you got home.
Oh, dear. People tell you the magic's gone.
Yeah, I don't know.
Oh, well, anyway.
Presumably the incentive is to try and get yourself heard on the record. So if you're at the front, you're the person who shouts out the hilarious thing.
I am
song.
On a Guns N' Roses
you're
recording.
You're kidding.
Oh, really? Go on.
They played at the... it's their first UK show. They played at the Marquee, and they had 4 nights or 3 nights, and I went to 2 of them. And I knew they were recording it because there was a mobile truck outside. And during the encores, they did a whole lot of Rosie by AC/DC and Knocking on Heaven's Door. So during the quiet bits of Knocking Heaven's Door, I just screamed my head off. And it came out as the B-side of Mr. Brownstone, and there I am.
You must have won a lot of friends.
Can we find that?
What did everybody else
think? I've got a recording of it, yeah.
Have you?
God,
yeah. What did all the people around you think? Were they thrilled to be standing next to you?
No one complained.
Because what are the great shouts out of the audience? What are the great legendary shouts out of the audience? There's, of course, Is it Whipping Post on the Allman Brothers Live at the Fillmore East? Somebody shouts Whipping Post?
That's right, yes.
Which everybody used to go to gigs afterwards.
For and a while after. Whipping
and shout Whipping Post. Even if you were going to see Ducks
if
Deluxe.
You see Wishbone Ash.
It didn't matter. Whipping Post!
I don't
just,
know that one.
It's what everybody did. And you can hear somebody on the Rolling Stones Get Your Yah-Yahs Out, where a young woman with it sounds faintly bored, actually. Quite obviously near enough the front to be picked up by the onstage microphone. It goes, "Paint it black, you devils."
Weird thing to
it's
shout.
A really
that's
weird
a
thing
very
to
weird
shout.
Thing.
But it's, you know, and she's probably in her 60s now, you know, and that thing is still out there being listened to by people nowadays. In fact,
maybe she's in her 60s then. She's some old dear at the front
yes.
wagging a finger
yes.
at them.
Turn it know? Down, you yeah, fools. Yeah. Anyway, one thing we have, one person we haven't talked about because we haven't had a podcast since Jimmy Savile died that we were able to talk about. The passing of Jimmy Savile. It seems to me to be a fascinating figure.
Well, God, I've read quite a few obituaries, and I must admit, I learned a great deal about him I didn't know. I mean, let's be honest, an extraordinary fellow.
Well,
and
well, it also
hard to love in some ways.
Very hard to love.
We love to say, you ever met him?
Very, very cold.
Yeah. Oh, Lord. And very peculiar, but did some extraordinary things. You know, that whole kind of physical fitness thing rather impressed me, really, because anybody who can run a marathon in their, whatever it is, 70s or something, clearly must have been supernaturally fit early on. And he did the most extraordinary things, didn't he? Wasn't he actually an athlete at one point?
Well, he was a wrestler.
A
professional wrestler. I think he lost 100 bouts.
Did he win any?
I think he won 12 or something. Okay.
He lost 100.
But you see, there's so much about Jimmy Savile, so much of what we know about Jimmy Savile, we only have one source for that knowledge, and that is...
Jimmy Savile.
Who was, you know, a man not above, you know, exaggerating his achievements occasionally.
Are you referring to the two turntables and a microphone?
Well,
thing?
Two turntables and a microphone is a very good point, because... I think it... Let's go through this quickly. Zoom
did
through.
Did he
very
exaggerate
early
the
life.
Fact that he worked in the mines?
No, he didn't. No,
accident?
Not at all. Yeah. Not at all. Because he was born very poor in a large, you know, family of Irish Catholic extraction in Leeds. And nobody had any money. And this is in the 1920s and 30s. And his dad was a bookies runner. And he went down the mines as a Bevan boy. And Bevan boys were chaps who were in the kind of late teens during the war who didn't quite qualify for military service, but instead there was a project for them to go down the mines, you know, to replace coal miners who joined the army and so forth. And so he was one of them. He was a Bevan boy, so he'd be underground about the age of 16 or 17, which is pretty remarkable, yeah. Which is almost Victorian.
God, you're down there in the dark, hacking away at the coal face, and the voice goes, as it happens, the glowing end of a cigar butt lights up. The canary turns over and dies in its cage.
He hadn't quite got that far at that point. He was in an accident that badly hurt his back, and so he's kind of invalided out of the Bevan boys. But he's a very enterprising soul. And he used to say, and I sort of believe this bit, that he was the first person in Britain to sell tickets for an occasion where people came and danced to records. Because the whole notion of dancing to records, nobody can understand why anybody would do it. You dance to a band, and there were bands all over the place. You know, that's just the natural
we
state.
We just ran a piece about this in Word, actually, and, about an American equivalent of this. Yeah.
And so he took some hall, some sort of Masonic hall in Leeds, a room above a hall or something, 1943, and just printed up some tickets saying, record dance, 1 shilling. And didn't know who'd turn up, but of course a bunch of people did turn up. And he just played. He had about 12 records that he somehow borrowed, because his proud boast throughout his career was he didn't own any records at all. Your records were complete tools, you know, they were just things you got, you know. And so he found this was a success, and it was, you know, on a small scale, quite revolutionary.
I'd love to know what they were.
And then later on, he reckoned that he was the first person, probably in Britain, to put together two turntables in order to go smoothly from one record into another. Now, there are people argue, oh, those machines were on sale anyway in the 30s in the United States or whatever. But they probably wouldn't have reached Leeds.
No.
And so he got involved in the kind of ballroom business in the West Riding of Yorkshire, and ran a load of ballrooms for Mecca, the Mecca group. It used to be called the Mecca Locarno. These are kind of ballrooms I vaguely remember as a kid, you know, that they would be patronised on Saturday night by miners, very smartly dressed miners, you know, going there to drink 8 pints, have a fight, and pull a girl called Shirley.
We've all been there.
We've all been there. And if you go and watch the film Saturday Night and Sunday Morning or A Kind of Loving or any other, there's always a scene in the Mecca ballroom. So Jimmy Savile ran that kind of thing.
Did he claim that he'd invent all that?
I think he bigged up his part, but, you know, like all those guys do.
So there'd be no Sugar Hill Records, there'd be no Mixed Man.
Well, I know. I think that sort of thing would have occurred anyway. But it's a pretty significant shift,
isn't
it? It
is, true,
the idea that come along and just dance to some records.
Yeah.
Which now we accept is a major leisure activity of millions of people all over the world.
But I wonder what was his main motivation. Do you think it was to collect the one shilling at the door?
Of course it was.
From his love of music.
No, absolutely. The shilling at the door, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
But to be fair, in his lifetime, he diverted a lot of shillings.
He did.
Into very good courses, didn't he?
Yeah, absolutely.
I don't think it was necessarily done, you know, to make himself rich.
No.
But he had the most curious kind of self-aggrandising streak that there's a bench on the seafront at Scarborough, which is where he's ended up being buried, at a certain angle so he can see the sea.
Yeah. That's right, he's at 45 degrees.
Yes. Isn't he? But there was a bench for years.
Yeah, more than that, he tipped into it.
On the front that had been put up there, and he had a plaque on it saying, Sir Jimmy Savile, but not yet. and who'd paid for that? Jimmy Savile. And he used to put about these stories. He put about the story that was picked up by loads of newspapers, that he spent every Christmas with Margaret Thatcher, which is nonsense.
I used to think that was very extraordinary.
He just made it up.
No disrespect to the late Jimmy Savile. I would have thought she would have been very strapped for company on Christmas Day if she had to ring up.
Maybe she wanted to reenact the old record dances of yore. But wasn't there a comedy sketch that depicted Margaret Thatcher and Jimmy Savile having Christmas Day? You know, because everything Jimmy Savile did very quickly became the kind of, it became comedy, didn't it?
Oh,
cartoonable or whatever. And so the myth and the reality just completely merged. And people used to tell terrible stories about Jimmy Savile, none of which I've ever seen a shred of evidence for at all.
No.
And, you know, not post-death either. It was just one of those targets that people were, you know, quite comfortable having a go at, because he never belonged inside the kind of hip tent,
did he?
You have been listening to the free feed of the Word podcast. The full album-length version is only available to subscribers to the magazine. To sign up and to hear the rest of this podcast, go to www.wordpodcast.co.uk.